have something special. You have greatness in you. Hello, this is Les Brown, and I have a special guest who's going to interview me, and I'm going to interview him. And it is my son, my second oldest son, Patrick. Hello, Patrick. How are you?
I'm great. How are you doing today, Dad?
I'm better than good and better than most. Patrick is the CEO of Preparing for Tomorrow. Patrick, when did you come up with the concept?
I actually came up with the concept for Preparing for Tomorrow about 1997. I was looking to start a business for myself, thinking of what I could create to make a difference in the world, you know, to go on with the legacy that you've established for us.
Okay. So now, when you're saying preparing for tomorrow, the optimists say the future belongs to those who prepare for it. I believe that the future belongs to those, not only those who prepare for it, but those who create it. And maybe that's one and the same thing. How do you feel about that?
That's very true. Actually, preparing for tomorrow is all about seeing yourself in the future and where you want to go. So it's about the steps that you take today to make a difference in your life. So tomorrow, if you do show up in tomorrow's, that you're prepared for it.
All right. So when you look at yourself now, and I started out at 37. How old were you when you made the decision that you were going to go in this direction to live a life that's bigger than you, a life that will outlive you?
That's a good question. I made the decision a long time ago, but with a big, giant man like yourself, it was kind of hard to get out of your shadow. So that's something that I kind of stayed in the background and let you do your thing. And I really believe probably when I was very young, I actually made the decision. It was just a matter of the right timing, I would say, for me to do it. And within that process, I actually went through a lot of different challenges as well as accomplishments throughout my life that have prepared me for this moment. Especially observing you all these years, it's almost second nature for me to do what I do. It's kind of I avoided it my entire life because mm-hmm. it was your thing. And like I try to explain, people sitting front row watching you my entire life is like when you're a kid watching commercials. After a while, you just kind of know the commercials. So a lot of this stuff is really second nature for me.
When people see me, they say, oh, he's just a natural. It wasn't always like that, was it?
No, not at least, not at all. I watched you, wow, long before you even started getting major platforms, just speaking any and everywhere to any and every audience that you could imagine. I can remember going to Whitehall. We went to a church. It was just like a community meeting. Mm-hmm. And you came in and you spoke. They did a little prayer. You came in and did your thing. And it was like amazing. Like we just go from one place to another. People really don't recognize or realize the type of footwork that was really put into being who you are today.
Yeah, going from city to city, hotel to hotel, event to event.
I'm talking long before that, before the hotels, when we were going to churches, when we were just little kids and you were going into churches and speaking, and you were going you were an activist in the neighborhood, you were downtown at the State House. You did a lot of grassroots speaking long before you actually got on a really major stage.
And you recall the dinners at the churches we needed to eat?
Yes, right. That was what we used to do. We'd go to church on Sunday so we could have Sunday dinner.
Those events, I'm telling you. You guys remember more stuff than I remember. I was just doing it. But did you think I would ever stop?
No. Didn't think you'd ever stop. It's ironic. I knew eventually it was going to lead somewhere because you made major impact wherever you went. You just really love what you do and what you were doing at the time. That's what's really amazing more about anything else. I try to explain to people. I said, my father's the only person I've ever seen who really loves what he does. He doesn't want to stop.
That's true. I'm going strong. I'm still at it 3/4 of a century. But let me ask you now, you love rap music and you found a way, you and your brother, that you were able to marry positive words with rap, the rhythm, the music, and make an impact because you are not only a speaker and a coach, but you're a good writer. I love your writing. And so let me hear one of your pieces that you feel that has been the most powerful and impactful with an audience.
Well, I usually do an intro. I do this one called It's Time. Mm-hmm. It's time. Not a moment to spare. So much to share. See, I understand that life's not fair. Let me see if I can explain why I still care. You see, the essence of you and I, it's oh so rare. The blessings we often miss, cause they stand out like they're really not there. You know, like all 10 fingers and toes, brown eyes and a nose to breathe in oxygen, the life force released by plants as we breathe out carbon dioxide, the life force for plants. So many uncanny connections, like 3/4 is universe, the world, and our bodies are made of water. And the greatest thing I see is when I give my all to being me, consciously, deliberately, living in the here and now, knowing that the seeds I plant determine the rewards I reap. Careful what you speak, because all words don't come cheap. I know a man that constantly spoke of death, and now he embraces eternal sleep. Now what that tells me, that which I speak into existence, I will eventually see. So I focus my energy onto activities that empower me. Relentlessly stretching, passionately and persistently progressing, meeting with people, getting involved in projects, in a constant state of prayer. Because I understand that life's not fair, but I'm going to take advantage of time as long as I'm here. It's time.
Okay. Well, you could have the writing area. I won't do that one.
Okay. You were quite the poet of your day. LB, Triple P, the platter player, popping none before you, none after, therefore making you the one and only, young and single, love to mingle, certified, bona fide, and duly qualified to bring you satisfaction, a whole lot of action. Look out, baby, I'm your love man.
Oh, behave.
Oh, behave.
Oh, my goodness. Well, when you think about the various things, Les Brown, the community activist, Les Brown, the radio personality, Les Brown, the motivational speaker, Les Brown, the state representative, Les Brown, the MC in nightclubs. You've seen various versions of me.
I have. I've watched you start from nothing to who you are today. I've seen it from day one, which was amazing. It was amazing. It's been an amazing journey.
So when you look at, given how little I had to work with to have made the kind of global impact that I've made, do you ever wonder, say, I remember your sister saying, Serena, how did he do it?
No, I didn't wonder how you did it. I know how you did it. Like I said, I've watched you when long before it ever became a dream at all. It was just something that you did second nature. More so, what I had to learn from you was the walk of faith. I call it a faith walk.
What do you mean by that?
A faith walk is that, like you said, you didn't have any resources. You didn't have any background in this, and you didn't have any type of following, but you just followed your heart. Regardless, no matter what the circumstances, no matter what the odds were against you, you just pressed forward. It was a walk of faith, and I'm learning to do that now. As a matter of fact, I do that now. It's a walk of faith, even though things look grim and doesn't look like there's no way things can work out. You have a plan of action, decide, and you determine you're going to do something. You just keep pressing forward, and life will take a toll. It will give in to you. It will relinquish itself. It will open you. Whatever it is you're going towards, you just keep pressing towards it, and you'll make a breakthrough. It's guaranteed. I've witnessed it over and over again. I'm like, this man has lost his mind. And be like, worked out again. I be doggone. No. But this isn't a good plan. What are you doing? Okay, it's worked out again. I be.
Yes, you have to just keep it on. Ogmandino said, I will persist until I succeed. What's your goal? What's your dream? What is it you want to do with your life? Here's what I can tell you. You have something special. I can tell you that it's possible, but you've got to decide that it's necessary and that it's you and that it's hard. Easy is not an option, but what will make it worth it for you not to quit on yourself? And once you determine that, Nietzsche said, if you know the why for living, you can endure almost anyhow. It's done. Stick a fork in it. It's done. Thank you, Mr. Patrick.
You're welcome, Dad. Thank you.
I'm so proud to have you as my son. You have something special. You have greatness in you. I was listening to the news, and they said 47,000 450 people die from opioids every year. That's 130 people a day. Hello, this is Les Brown. And I'd like to have a conversation with my son, Patrick Brown, about this. I found that there are two types of addicts. Those who seek narcotics, like opiates, and those who are prescribed them. Patrick, you and your brothers and sisters orchestrated an intervention with me. What caused you to do that?
What caused us to do that was, which we were dealt with, was your addiction to opioids that at first I didn't even realize was an addiction. It was really rather frightening. I went on, started going on the road with you in the summer of June of 2015, and I was told that you had a pain that I was supposed to prevent from coming by giving you these Percocets or oxycodone every 4 hours. So I would get up every 3.5 hours to create a smoothie so that you could wake you up to catch the pain. Because if you woke up, you would wake up in total pain. It wasn't until into the second half year that I realized that we had more of a problem. This was not a pain. This was a mental illness that we were dealing with. It was not a physical pain that you were actually encountering.
But I needed the pills, though, to deal with the pain.
You needed the pills to deal with the addiction. You needed the pills initially, but that's where the problem came into. You kept telling me you were in pain and you would get up and start running around the room. You'd say, my leg is hurting. I'm in pain. I'm like, if your leg is hurting, sit down. You know, first off, this is the problem. Like he's running around the room and his leg is hurting. I'm like, your leg can't be hurting. And you're up and running around. So, oh, my leg is like, dude, your leg is not hurting. So I literally had to tell my brothers and sisters didn't understand. I said, look, you have to see him so you can see what I'm talking about. And then once they come, it's like, oh, so yes, watch. He's going to say he's in pain. Then he's going to get up and start running around the room. It's like, who runs around the room when your leg's in pain? Mm. And that's when I was like, okay, there is a problem here.
And so how did you organize and convince them to come to Serena's house, your baby sister, to confront me?
I had, like I said, I kept talking to them on the phone and tried to explain it to them, and they couldn't understand it because none of us had ever dealt with this opioid addiction thing. We've all grew up in the crack era, but this is a whole different type of disease that we're dealing with. I said, you have to see him. I said, I can't explain it to you. When you see Dad and you see what he's doing, then you'll understand what I'm telling you. There's a problem.
And so when did you do the research to reach out to a drug program to get me committed?
When you stayed at Serena's house, and that's where the problem with Serena was. She saw you at her house, and then you started explaining to me how many pills you were taking, and I was like, oh my God. And she was saying you would take the pills and you would be in the basement. She would come down to see if you were still breathing, because you were doing the strongest dosage of oxycodone and you were taking four at a time.
Mm-hmm.
And so from her watching that and being concerned about you dying in her house, and then it was really crazy. You were taking the pills, had you. You were tucking pills everywhere. You took two pills, put them in the side of the couch where you sat at. You took two pills and put them up under the placemat in the car when we was driving. You had pills. You had them stuck in little secret places in your book, in your little bag that you carried. You were just stashing, like he's stashing these pills so that he can access them at all times.
When you guys drove me to the drug program, and I stayed there for 5 days. I think you had me committed and paid for me to be there much longer. And I called and say, come get me.
Yes.
After I had a confrontation with the director, and I said, there are people who prescribe opioids and there are people who seek them. And he told me, every junkie has a story. I picked up the telephone on his desk, I'd bust him in the head. And a lady, fortunately, who was there, a nurse, said, Mr. Brown, trouble is easy to get in, but hard to get out. And I called you and Serena to come get me, or I'll walk home and freeze to death, but I wasn't going to stay anymore, that I was going to get off this by myself. And you and I argued. We almost fought in the car all the way back. Did y'all think that I can do it?
At the time, no, not at all. When we got there, it was still a mess. They told us, when they told us you were ready to go. And then it's really a mess. We had to take you out of there anyway because of the fact it was to our disadvantage due to the fact that you are the poster child for encouraging people how to change their life. We go into, me and Serena go into ask this young man and these two young men's like, hey, how's our father? We just want to know how he did in the program. And these men came out their mouths and said, well, great source of knowledge and information. And we just busted out laughing. It was like, did we get snow? And I'm like, just give us our father, please. Just give us our father. Oh my God. He did not come here to motivate you or inspire you. He came here for treatment. And apparently you've kind of missed the bus. And by day four, we found out you had spoke at the AA meeting. It's like, oh my, well, he's not, he's here for treatment. He's not here to be teaching people. So it was a waste. It was kind of a waste of time, but it still got us on the right track to getting you towards recovery. Because the first thing I told you was that you were addicted and you kept on saying you wanted to find somebody who could get rid of this pain. And we had been in Ohio State for 8 days. They couldn't get rid of your pain. We went to the West Coast, USC, 5 times. They gave you a shot of morphine. It didn't touch your pain. We went to Atlanta, got some of the best doctors. That couldn't touch your pain. We got back to Columbus, took you to a rehab. They gave you a shot of the Suboxone, and within 10 minutes, your pain was gone. You tell me on the phone, I knew someone could fix this pain. I'm like, you're at a drug rehab, and you have an addiction. They gave you a shot for addiction. No, and then I got to get to pick you up. Said, Dr. Patrick, they said I do have pain. You do have some pain, but that's not the major problem we're dealing with at this point.
And I did not stay on Suboxone. I got off and I did it myself.
I don't know. You did it. It was a long, hard road, Mr. Brown.
It's absolutely
nothing to be proud of.
It was
quite a struggle. It was still very frightening. It was a hard road uphill. And just thankful that you made it to the other side, because like I said, I'd never in my life experienced. I've dealt with drugs and dibbled and dabbled, but never done this opioid addiction. It was just a whole new beast. I said, I've never seen this.
And they said that I was too old to go cold turkey, and I did.
Yes, you did. Okay.
Thank you very much. I don't suggest it for anybody, because it was a living hell. The gagging, the dry heaves, the cold sweats, the passing out, being rushed to the hospital. It was a challenge. But I got through it. They said I couldn't because I was in my 70s. But I said, I am not going to take Suboxone, which is a drug that you get addicted to. And it's the addiction is more challenging than the other drugs. And so it's difficult, even more so, to get off Suboxone. So I say, no, I'm not doing that. And I did it.
Yes, and it was a blessing that you've always done what you've done with the positive message and affirmations, because you were still speaking. And when you do opioids, they change your mental thinking, and you have to rearrange it. So with all the positive information that you've always been doing, it kind of rewired your thinking. You already had a fighter's mentality and a positive outlook on where you wanted to go with your life. So it made a real big difference in how you were able to make it out, because most people just have an addiction and they don't have a good attitude. Everything they've come from has been either hard or struggles and hardships, so they don't have a way of figuring out, how do I get over this? How do I fight in this type of situation? And you're a natural fighter for that type of thing. You know, you're all about proving people wrong.
Yes, I am.
Overcoming the odds.
Yes. Life is a fight for territory. And once you stop fighting for what you want, what you don't want will automatically take over. This has been Les Brown and his pride and joy, his son, Patrick Brown. You have something special. You have greatness in you. That's our story.
And we're sticking to it.
You are listening to Les Brown Greatness Radio, positive and motivational content curated by the legendary Les Brown.